All right, guys, today we're going to be speaking with Chris Hutchins from Grove. He is the founder and CEO. This startup is totally going to disrupt the financial planning industry, which has a black mark on its face and has had a black mark for years due to this lack of fiduciary responsibility. Chris is doing what we all dream of doing, identifying a problem and coming up with a practical solution to solve it. And I think this particular episode is going to touch on the solution he came up with to solve this problem and then show you how all the principles that we talk about in the FI community integrate into that solution. I am incredibly excited about this episode. And with that, welcome to the Choose FI Radio Podcast.
You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI. Your home for financial independence online.
So Brad and I heard Chris Hutchins for the first time on the Mad Scientist podcast last October. Brad was just immediately over the moon. He hopped on the phone with Chris, and shortly thereafter, he sent me a text saying, I spoke with him for about an hour, and he's basically me, just me, who in an alternate universe sold a company to Google and lives in California. He's awesome. So immediately I knew I had to go find out a little bit more about Chris Hutchins' story, and I found an episode that he had done with Kevin Rose, who's the founder of Digg. And Kevin described him as the go-to personal finance hacker for Silicon Valley. This is clearly someone that the FI community can get excited about. And it's amazing to see how these concepts and ideas are rapidly spreading across the country. And I'm incredibly excited about this episode. To help me with this, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great, Jonathan. Yeah, this should be a fun one. I really enjoyed my conversation with Chris. It was just amazing how, even listening to him, he used the same language that I use around credit card rewards, around your credit score. It was almost eerie. And I'm like, holy cow, I have to get to know this guy. It's amazing. And he is just such an interesting story. And it really runs the entire gamut of the FI universe, from house hacking to entrepreneurship to life optimization to travel rewards. I mean, it literally is everything. So this should be a fascinating conversation. And with that, Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
So Chris, I guess the first question is, Kevin Rose describes you as the go-to hacker for Silicon Valley. Now, in a geographic domain where I would imagine there's a lot of competition for that space, you've really developed a reputation. And I'm curious, what is behind that?
Life is busy in Silicon Valley. I'd say most of my friends are either running companies or working at high growth companies. So there's probably a little bit of a different spin than the traditional kind of life hacking, financial hacking that you'd see anywhere else, in that it's not a desire to spend 1,000 hours to save a couple extra dollars. It's like, what's the efficient way to start to learn how to life hack, whether it's rewards, whether it's with your house, whether it's, you know, anything. So maybe that's the slight spin that gave me a different story to tell.
So Chris, Silicon Valley has kind of this aura when you're outside of it. We hear about some of these people, like, you know, I've listened to Kevin Rose on the Tim Ferriss show, and then to see you as a guest on his show, it's almost like these people are little celebrities in our world. But obviously, they're just regular people. And they're also kind of optimizers at heart, I would think, just by being in this tech world. Do you find that people in Silicon Valley are as open or more open potentially to the FI message than people you meet in just the regular course of life?
Yeah, I mean, Silicon Valley is filled with people willing to take risk. You've got people who are faced with job opportunities in lots of industries and choose ones where they're making less money so that they can own a piece of the company they're working at. So by nature, people are willing to take risks that drive big rewards. And in the FI community, I kind of feel like there's two sides. One is the, I'm not going to take a lot of risk. I want to be really conservative. And then the other is, I'm actually going to take a lot of risk to try to bet big so that I can actually do this a lot earlier. And so the latter group seems to really, really resonate with the Silicon Valley mentality of take risk, put yourself out there, and try to achieve the most optimal outcome you can.
Where do you personally fall on that risk to safety continuum?
It's funny, you know, with my personal investment strategy, you'd look at it and say, Chris isn't that risky of a person. He lives in Silicon Valley. He's not actively angel investing in startups. I don't have all my money in cryptocurrency. On the personal side, though, right now I'm getting paid a significant, you know, tiny amount compared to the salary I could earn in other careers for the sole purpose of starting a company and the opportunity to kind of change the world of personal finance. So with my work life, I am very risky, which means that maybe I balance it out by being quite conservative on the investment side.
That strikes me as very similar to my mentality. I don't know if I've ever been able to verbalize it quite as succinctly, but I feel very comfortable with index investing, yet I was willing to leave like a guaranteed six-figure steady income that wasn't going anywhere to go work on a startup that completely, you know, held all of my attention and all of my passion. So I totally see the overlap there. Were you a coder like from birth? I mean, is this just, you know, you're in Silicon, you're doing a startup. Was this your background in high school and college?
No. I mean, I would say I was definitely a computer nerd. I definitely had a computer growing up. You know, I remember when we first got CompuServe followed by America Online, and like I wasn't the cool kid who didn't know about computers. Let's put it that way. But I never really took up programming beyond just kind of interesting ways to learn about what's happening on the internet. I wasn't a software engineer by trade. I listened to different tech podcasts and software and internet. And when Dig was really popular, it was exciting to see the internet taking off and becoming more of a cool thing. But, you know, I definitely wasn't an engineer. I didn't actually know that this was an industry I wanted to go in when I left college.
Chris, when did your ultra optimizing start? Does this date back to when you were a kid? Was it something that you came upon after you started your first job? Or, you know, talk us through your own history of optimizing your life and your money, I guess.
So this is one of the worst questions for me because I really don't feel like I know exactly the genesis of my optimizing nature. I attribute a lot of it to my grandparents. I think they instilled this concept in me early on. They retired super early for their generation, probably in their early 50s maybe, and moved to a retirement community, and they loved to travel. And they decided that they were going to start a company where they would take groups of people in their retirement community on organized tours all around the world, and they would be able to travel for free for organizing it. So in some ways, my grandparents were like Phi members themselves. They retired early, and they found a way to sustain their entire retirement while continuing to enjoy the thing they loved the most, which was traveling around the world.
So you got to see them living this Phi lifestyle, even when there wasn't a term for it. But were there ever conversations about money with them or with other members of your family? Like, were there overt conversations that you recollect about money?
I don't remember. I mean, my grandparents were incredibly frugal. We would go on a family vacation to a timeshare of theirs in Mexico, and they would bring 4 suitcases before we had to pay bag fees, and they would be filled with food because they didn't want to have to buy food when we were staying in Mexico. So all the conversations about money were usually the family telling my grandparents, like, why are you bringing food? We're going on this vacation. Mexico is not even an expensive city. And why, you know, half of this food's expired. What is going on? So it was never directly addressed as to why they were doing it, but it was kind of so clear in every one of their actions that they were doing it because for them, there were so many things more important than being lavish.
Yeah, that's absolutely fascinating. And to your point about it being a hard question to answer, I don't know if I could trace my genesis of how I became frugal or an optimizer or saver, but I suspect similar to you, it's you just take in these kind of context clues from your family, from people that you see operate on a day-to-day or with extended family, you know, maybe month-to-month or year-to-year basis, and just kind of internalize that. I always wonder, like, how that's going to impact my own kids. And I suspect, similar to you, where your grandparents are taking this food, like, we've done that before. I'm sitting here sheepishly, like, wincing when you're saying that. Like, I hope my kids don't think we're cheap, as opposed to just, wow, they're trying to optimize. And I'm also curious, so your grandparents, I'm not sure if that's on maternal or paternal side, but did their kids take those same frugal habits or did they rebel against them?
I would say somewhere in the middle. So it's on my mother's side. And if I look across her entire sibling, she had 2 brothers and a sister. And, you know, none of them took the far end of rebellion side and spent crazy money on all these things and bought nice cars and all that stuff. So they definitely didn't go to the other side. But they're definitely not as frugal. Like, they definitely saw this, what they maybe would describe as somewhat limiting life choice, and decided that, you know, we don't have to do that. Maybe we could, you know, afford to buy food when we travel. And so I guess years of kind of teasing and making fun of it led them to go to the other end. My mom would always tell me stories about how their house would be filled with extra tinfoil and extra toilet paper because it was on sale. And that was certainly not something that, you know, we had or was encouraged or part of our lifestyle growing up.
And was it always entrepreneurship for you? I mean, was this from day one, you were the kid selling candy bars after school? I mean, were you an entrepreneur growing up as well?
Yeah, I mean, I was always looking to start some random thing. I was the kid who made t-shirts and sold them in high school for a big football game. You know, I started a newspaper in elementary school. I don't think there was any money to be made from that business, but it was just like something I did because I thought it was fun and exciting. So I could definitely trace back my entire life, little entrepreneurial things, and even things that weren't related to business, but we had a hill in our street. And so I was like, oh, you know what? When it snows, I grew up in Virginia. Let's build little jumps on this hill in my street. And I can invite all my friends over and we're going to have a little snowboard park. And, you know, it wasn't a business, but it was certainly like this idea that, is there a way to get the thing you want without having to pay for it or, you know, travel for it or work for it? Like what's the way to optimize this?
So you graduate from college, and at this point, is it just, all right, it's time to go to Silicon Valley, I'm going to be a startup, or did you pursue a more traditional path out the gate?
Honestly, this is, you know, embarrassing, but I don't think I knew that the passion I had for technology and entrepreneurship had a home anywhere in the country or even a career path. So, you know, when I left college, funny enough, the person I ended up starting my current company with, I had met him over Thanksgiving, my senior year of college, and he had told me, you know, he got this job and it starts in New York and at Barclays Bank and, you know, it's all lined up. And I thought, wow, why do you have a job? We don't graduate for 8-9 months. And I kind of quickly realized that for some super competitive jobs, you get them really, really early in your senior year. And I was like, oh man, I'm so far behind. I haven't even thought about what I wanted to do when I graduate. I need to get a job. What are these jobs that are so good? And my now co-founder, also named Chris, said investment banking and management consulting, like basically those are the jobs that everyone wants. They're the best jobs when you graduate. I was like, I don't know what I want to do, but it sounds like I have to do that. So I went back to my university and I had a pretty good relationship with the dean of the College of Business. And I said, hey, I would love a job in investment banking and management consulting. Can you help? And so for my first two jobs out of college, we're at an investment bank and a management consulting firm that he helped kind of introduce me to. And I don't think I had a clue that there was actually this whole industry that I wish that I would have known about earlier.
Chris, we're always looking for life hacks. And just something you touched on right there just jumped out to me. How did you have that relationship with the dean that he or she would go to bat for you to get you a job at an investment banking firm, which is not easy to come by? Like, how does that even come to pass?
Yeah, so I think I had this theory, and I'll give credit to my former ex-girlfriend for getting me to look at a school that I never would have looked at, but which was Colorado State University. And when I went out there, I kind of had this idea that, wow, you know, I could go to, you know, maybe I could go to any school, but, you know, I could go certainly to a school that was a little bit, you know, more prestigious or challenging, but then I'd just be one of a bunch of kids at a challenging school trying to make my way to the top. Or I could go to a school that was maybe a little less challenging and it might be easier to stand out. And in my mind, it was which one actually produces the best result? I do still regret that I didn't have the most academically challenging college career, but on the flip side, I put myself in a situation where it was much easier to stand out. And so it was much easier to start to build relationships with people that were important or influential. So some of the professors I built relationships with, I'm still friends with. The dean of the College of Business, I'm still friends with. Some of the people in the alumni group, I'm still friends with. And so that, I would say, I probably landed a job out of Colorado State that had I gone to Harvard, maybe wouldn't have even been possible.
Chris, that's absolutely astounding. I know I said before, like you use almost the same words as me, like in other instances. And that is the first time that I've ever heard someone use almost the exact same line of reasoning for going to a college as I used. I mean, it's almost verbatim. It's crazy. I got in similar to you, got into a couple of the, you know, top 10 or 15 schools in the country, but decided not to go there because, well, many reasons. Financial was certainly part of it, but part of it was I didn't want to be this tiny little fish in a big pond of other ultimate genius kids who are vastly more intelligent and better than I am. Whereas I actually went to the University of Richmond, which, oh, poor me, it's, you know, still a top 50 or 60 school in the country. And I was able to be the vice president of the student government there. I was friends with the dean. I'm still friends with my accounting professor, who was basically the top accounting professor in the country, and also helped me. So it's amazing how just getting involved in that community at your college, it doesn't have to be an elite school. It can be any school. It's find that community and find people that you can connect with, even if they are the dean of the university. Relationships matter. I think that's the big takeaway for me.
Absolutely. I think that's just like half of the life hacks, is just realize that, and it's hard to realize when you're young, but realize that there are a bunch of people, they're probably older than you, and they probably know a lot more than you. And as a kid who likes to be entrepreneurial, part of that is often rebellion, but figuring out that there's some balance between rebellion and accepting that the people that you may want to rebel against know a lot and are smart and have lots of relationships and could be great people to get to know. Finding that balance, I think, was very helpful and influential in my educational years.
You know, so I'm trying to tie these threads from where you were, and it sounds to me like this is it. Like, this should be where the story goes. This investment banking and consulting, that is a dream job for many people. That is, if I can get there, I am set. I'm wondering, was it everything you hoped for when you got it? Was that your perfect job that you landed? I would imagine that there must have been some issue with it, because it's not what you're fighting for now, but I'd love to get your perspective on that.
Yeah, so in the true spirit of optimization, I was a little late to the game. You know, most people had already lined their jobs up. So the consulting firm that I had gotten a job at, I'd missed their kind of post-graduation start date. So they offered me a March start date, and I was graduating in May, so I had 10 months. And the other job offered me a June start date. So I just accepted both jobs. I told them, yep, great. I'd love to start in March. I'll, you know, figure something out to do for 10 months. And so I started working at the first job, enjoyed it. It was fun. It was interesting. Investment banking is, you know, a fascinating world for someone out of college to be in, because you literally work on and sit on in the middle of, you know, the largest mergers and acquisitions in the world and IPOs. And it's amazing. But the lifestyle of an investment banker, there is very little, you know, meritocracy or upward movement in investment banking, because the expectation is if you're the youngest, most junior person on the team, you're doing all of the work. And the only work anyone else does is work that you either can't do or work that can't be done in the 24 hours in the day. And the limit of 24 hours is a rough limit that sometimes caused me to not see my girlfriend, who's now my wife, awake for, you know, an entire week in a row. So the devil you don't know is always better. So when it came time to get near March, I thought management consulting must be different than investment banking. It must be amazing. Let's do that. So I, you know, left the investment bank, started this management consulting job. And I will say it was a little bit more kind of in the spirit of a job I would want. But still, I struggled when, you know, I knew as a firm we were trying to win some business from a particular client that, you know, through a friend I had a good relationship with. And I was like, oh, can I just go sell the company's work? Can I go do the role of sales? And they're like, no, that's the role of someone three levels more senior than you. That doesn't work. And so I think just my general approach on work and take things on, you know, even if you're not supposed to, if you think you can impact the business positively, just didn't fit in with that lifestyle. So yeah, so those careers I could tell at both times weren't the right thing for me. But I owe the entire decision to move out to Silicon Valley to a guy named Andrew Hyde, who was living in Boulder at the time and had this idea to start something called Startup Weekend. And the vision was, you know, what if you just put a bunch of people in a room for an entire weekend and brought engineers and designers and business people and, you know, the likes, and let people pitch ideas, form teams, and build a company over the weekend. And somehow I'd found out that this was a thing and that one was coming to New York. And I was like, I have to do this. And I went to it and I was like, this is the most amazing thing. This is what I want to do. Is there a place I can do this? And everyone was like, yeah, everyone does this in Silicon Valley. That's all you do there. And I was like, I have to go there. Like, that's where I need to go. And I think 2 weeks later, they did another startup weekend in Boston. And I drove up to Boston that weekend from New York, did it again. And I was like, yep, I'm definitely right. I have to move to Silicon Valley. And I think the Monday after that startup weekend, I went in and asked Monitor, the company I was working for, to transfer me to their San Francisco office.
So, but you're not a coder. You're not a software developer. You're a guy that likes computers just like me growing up, but you haven't cultivated this particular skill set. But the idea still fascinated you. And I'm curious, what is it like to go to that environment with the degree of being an investment banker and start creating these types of business ideas? You know, who gives you permission to do that?
Yeah. So a really good friend of mine, one of the first people that introduced me to, you know, the world of Silicon Valley, described himself and, you know, ultimately people like him and me as non-technical, no talent ass clowns, because we're in a world in Silicon Valley where everyone has some degree or skill that applies towards software design, software creation, or has been doing it for years. So when I came out to Silicon Valley, I was still actually employed by this consulting firm for about 2.5 weeks before I got laid off. And, you know, we're at the height of 2008's financial crisis. So I didn't really know who to talk to. I didn't know who to get involved with. I had no marketable skills. I didn't know what I would even do at a startup, but I just knew that I had to be here. So I convinced my wife that this would be a great place to go. And she grew up in the mountains in Colorado. And so New York was, you know, the farthest thing from something that she was used to. And we had our fun there. And so we decided we were going to come here. And I don't think either one of us knew, you know, what we were about to get into.
So I guess your friend kind of tongue in cheek is calling you. You basically have no business being there. You don't have any specific talents or abilities to code or do anything like that. But obviously you're there and you've succeeded. I'm curious, when you look back on your list of skills that we call the talent stack that we've taken from Scott Adams, the author, what do you think has led to your success?
So when I first started talking to people about, okay, so what can I do at a startup? And I, you know, this person, this guy, Matt Van Horn, he now runs a successful hardware company called June. He was like, well, I'm doing business development. And I was like, oh, what's that? And the best I could understand it at the time was it's like sales, except you never have to cold call anyone. And I was like, oh, that sounds great. I could talk to people. You know, I've been selling random things and myself. It sounds like a great career. And I dug in and, you know, it basically was take a product that a company is working on and find more strategic in-depth partnerships than just selling something to someone. And I was like, oh, like what are the soft skills or hard skills required to do this? And it was really at the junior level, not a lot, like the ability to talk to people and, you know, understand what the company built. So I didn't know that I didn't necessarily have the skills to do it at a senior level, but the skills to do it at a junior level were just passion, hunger, and willingness to put yourself out there. So I was like, well, I checked that box. I can do that.
You know, I kind of threw you a softball there, specifically where I asked you who gave you permission, because I think that's the key. Stop waiting for somebody to give you permission, right? Isn't that what all of us think? That's what's holding us back. We're waiting for someone to give us the green light. Who's the gatekeeper? And I just love the fact that with you, you just moved to the left of that. You just went for it. And as soon as you even put any effort into it, you put yourself out there even a little bit. Now someone comes up beside you and says, well, you're working there, but if you moved a little bit to the left, the ground's a lot easier to till there and you're more likely to get better results. And don't go too far over there because that's some dangerous area and you want to avoid that. And immediately, like the input that people are able to give you because they're seeing something that's lighting you up drives you in the direction of what success will ultimately look like for you. And I just think your story is like the perfect highlighter for that.
Yeah, I mean, the first job I got out here was at a company called Simple Geo doing business development. And my approach to finding a job was, I'm going to find a company who whatever they're working on, I'm very excited about, the team is exciting, and I'm just going to apply to that one company. But I didn't just apply by sending a resume. I had found a friend who knew someone who was an investor. I'd gotten that investor to convince the founders to let me, you know, present something to them. And I made a, you know, probably 15, 20 slide presentation on why they should hire me. And I delivered it to them. And I think their reaction, which I sympathize with so much now that I'm, you know, in their shoes, is if a person's willing to go that far just to convince you that they can work for you in a role where there aren't actual hard skills necessary to do it, you should definitely hire that person. And I think that was what catapulted me into this entire career.
So you've come from this investment banking lifestyle. I would imagine, at least from the perspective of your peers, you want to maintain a certain wardrobe. You want to drive a certain car. You need to keep up certain amounts of appearances. You're in what's becoming rapidly one of the most expensive cities in the country, and you've just lost your job. You have no job. How does that work from a savings perspective? Like, what's keeping you afloat here?
Yeah. The first month we lived in San Francisco, I lived in the upstairs guest room of my middle school teacher's house, who somehow I had kept in touch with, until my wife, who I guess then was my girlfriend, had gotten a job. And that was enough to let us rent an apartment. So now we have an apartment and I'm sitting here thinking, what do I do to pay the bills, contribute? I ended up starting a conference called Laid Off Camp, which it seemed like a great idea for building my brand, because keep in mind, I had moved to San Francisco 3 weeks before. So fortunately, I had no appearances to keep up because I knew like three people in the entire city. So totally fine to eat beans and rice sitting at home and, you know, not need to spend any money on anything. Through the process of starting this conference, I was able to at least build a little bit of momentum and brand around myself, what I was doing. And, you know, we got some great news coverage, and that led me to, okay, I need to figure out how to make money, because you can only live on nothing and your girlfriend's salary for so long. So I think step one was find a way to make some side income. So I started picking up consulting projects related to skills that I had in the past. I found a company that needed a financial model for fundraising. I found a company that needed help throwing events. And I basically inventoried all the skills that I could demonstrate some ability to do professionally, and tried to find companies that needed those skills and didn't want to hire someone full-time to do them.
But again, that talent stack that you've demonstrated, is that tied to the Laid Off Camp conference that you created?
So event planning was tied to Laid Off Camp. You know, modeling and creating spreadsheets was more tied towards investment banking and management consulting. I think I did another project just thinking about technology for a company that was kind of old school. And maybe that wasn't tied to any professional thing, but it was more me trying to convince them that I knew what I was talking about. So it was all tied to some professional thing I did, but not all the same thing.
What about the network? Why did they trust you? Was this you cold calling different people to try and get one-off gigs?
Yeah, so one of them was a sponsor at a Laid Off Camp. One of them was just a random person someone introduced me to. And another was kind of a friend of a friend. So I honestly don't know why they trusted me. I didn't really have any hard evidence that should be behind that trust. But I think Silicon Valley is one of those places where people are willing to take leaps of faith when they see things that seem interesting, exciting, or promising.
Chris, I love this constant theme of this talent stack, all these skills. You said the inventory of skills, and then you found these companies, and then the relationships. I mean, you somehow or another kept in touch with your middle school teacher and stayed in their spare bedroom. I mean, that is really unusual, and it just struck me, and I wanted to point it out again. But I also wanted to talk about probably your most important relationship, which is with your then girlfriend, now wife. How does she feel about your kind of crazy optimizing and all these other things you do and your pursuit of Phi? What are her thoughts on Phi? And did you convert her, or was she a disciple from the beginning, I guess?
She was certainly not a disciple from the beginning. Try to put yourself in the shoes of someone who proposes as an alternative affordable housing option to move in with your middle school teacher. The look I had when my wife said, you want to move in with your teacher for a bit? I don't even know my teacher from middle school. How is this a thing? She wasn't at the other end of the spectrum, but she's always able to think about savings and being responsible, but she wouldn't take it to the extreme I did in any way. And I think over time, as she's watched the crazy things that we've done, the benefits that it's had, I think it's become more and more acceptable. But she also, you know, does very well for herself in her job. And I think there are times where her response is, look, I'm totally fine if you want to be super, super frugal, but I want to do this thing and I have a salary and I want to, you know, and I'm just going to do it. And then, you know, I'm totally fine with that. So I don't think we have to be at the same place, but I think you have to be close.
Yeah, I love what you said, take it to the extreme, right? So I can just picture it. Jonathan, it sounds like you and Danny, right?
Yeah, I'm always willing to push things, but I mean, she grounds me. So there is that balance if it's going to be sustainable. But, you know, it sounds like you've had at least a pretty good ground game in terms of not spending more than your means and being willing to be flexible with your lifestyle to adapt to, you know, whatever your current income levels are. And I guess maintain some form of savings to give you that buffer, that runway, as you guys were kind of scrambling to pick something up. But I think what's so interesting to me about your story, there's two aspects to this. One is that in my mind, one of the dangers of moving to Silicon Valley and having a lifestyle built there is that the lifestyle creep, the lifestyle inflation. I mean, once you make it, if you make it, there's so much pressure just to inflate everything else along with it. That's what I see over and over again. And I feel like it makes entrepreneurship a little bit more risky because you're always trying to maintain the current lifestyle and it becomes very hard to actually break the game, which is kind of what we're talking about here. And then also you're doing this alone. My understanding is you kind of found out about the Phi Movement long after you had actually reached Phi. You weren't like buried in this community from the beginning. So to me, your story is a little bit more impressive and I'd love to hear you comment on both of those.
Yeah, so definitely had no idea that this whole movement community even existed until I read a Mr. Money Mustache post at one point, like so many people have. And I think I had the same feeling you, Brad, had talking to me, which was like, oh my God, I totally get this. I've been doing this. This person's just like me. And while I didn't take it maybe that far and change where I lived and, you know, downgrade everything, like I still like to eat and travel, I would just try to figure every possible way to make it efficient. I agree with you about lifestyle creep. It's one of the things that I see drive some of the biggest financial problems for most people. For me, I just really embraced my frugality to the point that it was totally clear with everyone I'm around at any point in time that I'm just like laughably frugal. And so instead of feeling this like guilt or shame when people are like, oh, do you want to go out to dinner? Do you want to split the bill? Let's all get lots of drinks. And I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to get like an appetizer because I'm not that hungry and I don't really want to spend a lot of money. And it just got to the point that people are like, of course you're going to do that. That's just such a you thing to do. And I kind of owned it instead of feeling guilty about it.
You became a meme.
Yeah, essentially. Sometimes it's not the most fun thing to be, but it's become such a big part of my identity now that I think it's okay.
Ah, he's pulling a Hutchins. I can see it now.
Oh my God, I've heard that too many times now.
Yeah, so obviously there are good parts of that. It does sound like a fun and jovial type thing, but has there been any pushback? Have there been any situations where you found it as a negative in your current location?
Definitely. Here's a great example. There's an interesting event that happens every year called Summit at Sea. And it's this group of founders, makers, creators who organize this crazy excursion on a cruise ship that ends up costing a few thousand dollars. And it's only a couple days. And it's one of those things that I just can't bring myself to ever go on because it just seems too expensive. Like they don't take points. There's no way to pay for it other than giving real dollars. And other people I know have done it and they've come back and said, I've built some of the most valuable relationships of my life at events like these. So there is this one element of creating relationships and putting yourself in the right place at the right time that being super frugal totally would prevent you from ever doing. I've never been invited to TED, but I know that to go to TED, you end up spending $7,500 or $10,000 and everyone I know builds crazy, amazing relationships. But I just don't know if I could ever do it. Like, I honestly don't think I could ever pull the trigger, even if I was invited, because it's just so against my nature to spend that much money to just go to a place where you can watch people say things that are going to be on video a couple weeks later.
Brad, I feel like I'm talking to you right now.
It's unbelievable. It's really, truly unbelievable.
But that doesn't keep you from taking advantage of memorable moments. I want to like transition to this because one of the most powerful things I heard you say in an interview was that you like to carve out, I believe, was it one memorable moment from each month? Can you tell us a little bit more about that idea?
Yeah. So I make it a point every month to do one, you know, memorable thing. It has to be something that I've never done before or wouldn't normally do. It's sometimes difficult, especially when life's busy. But the inspiration came from the idea that I never wanted to be able to look back on life and have a month where there was just nothing worth remembering. You know, you just went to work, you hung out, you had dinner. I wanted to make sure that every month you could look back and be like, oh, that's the month I took that crazy donut making class, or that's the month I took a trip to Mexico, or something like that. And so every month I make it a goal to make sure that I'm doing something memorable.
Chris, I have a million questions. I want to really dive into this a little more because I heard you talk about this on the Mad Scientist podcast and you guys talked about it fairly in depth. But yeah, as I'm wont to do, I had 50 questions to follow up. So, okay. Do you log them? Do you have like a sheet that you can look back on the last 6 years that, hey, I did this X, Y, and Z, or is it just a mental thing?
No. Definitely have a sheet. I started doing it March 2014. I could go back every month all the way till then and say the activity that happened every month.
Awesome. What rises to the level of something that is this memorable moment? I'm not sure if that's the term you use or not, but memorable thing, whatever we want to call it. Like, how do you differentiate between, like, for me, my kids and I are going on a hike. Does that count as a memorable moment, or does it have to be something like unusual, different? Talk us through that.
Yeah. So I'd say there's no hard and fast requirements, because sometimes my wife's like, this is going to be my thing for the month. And I'm like, I don't know, that doesn't qualify for me. My requirement is essentially, it has to be something that I both haven't done before and wouldn't just do on a whim normally. Maybe those sometimes overlap, but someone was like, oh, let's go go-karting. I'm like, you know what? Like, go-karting, even if I'd never done it before, which I have, it just seems like something you could just go do on a whim. It needs to feel like something you've never done before. You probably won't just do next weekend because it was fun. And there's kind of something exciting and unique and memorable about it. And it can be really, really cheap. So for January, my wife and I went to a mirror maze. This thing called like Mr. Magawan's Magic Mirror Maze in San Francisco. And it was $5. And it's like a giant thing that you would normally see at a fun house or a carnival. And I think my whole childhood, every time I was at a carnival, I was like, oh, we should do the Magic Mirror Maze. It sounds so interesting. I'd never done it. And finally, someone had told me that they did the one in San Francisco. It was just amazing. I was like, that's what we're going to do this month. And so it doesn't have to be super expensive. It has to be a big enough thing that it's memorable and unique. And, you know, I'm not going to go back to the mirror maze every weekend.
That's really cool. So in that instance, was the mirror maze premeditated? Does it have to be something you plan, or can you just happen upon it? How do you split between that?
Either. Before starting a company, it was a much more premeditated, or it was, oh, I know this thing's happening. That's going to be what happens for January or February. Or, you know, my wife got me a whole hog butchery class where we went to this really cool butcher in Napa Valley. And we took a class where it's like how to cut down and prepare an entire pig. And I knew we were going to do that, you know, 2 months from now. So I was like, oh, I've got March done, ready to go. If I have a trip planned, that counts. If I'm doing something interesting, that counts. But if not, you know, I just make it a point to schedule something. So I think if I'm looking, you know, I pulled the list up. If I look back, there have been times where I was like, you know what? I don't really have anything for January 2017, but I've always thought it'd be fun to try acupuncture. So like, I'll go do acupuncture that week.
And is it a mix of personal and business? We haven't really talked about Grove a whole lot up to this point, but as you find it taking up more and more of your time, do you find that some of these memorable experiences are focused around your business?
Yeah, I wasn't sure if I should include business-related things or not, but if I look back, March 2015 was quit my job and start a company, and May 2016 was, you know, raise a seed round of capital for that money. Those are probably the only two professional ones. You know, if I had been doing this back in 2012, it would probably definitely be sell a company. But I'd say all of the other ones are personal. I think the reason or the rationale behind it is get your first 100 users or something like that. The next month, you'll have gotten 100 again. And so like, is the business thing memorable if you know that you're going to continue to do it? I don't know. So no, they haven't all been business related. Separately, I think as life gets so busy and work gets so demanding, the fact that I keep this more focused on personal really is like my outlet. So I know that every month I'm going to do something exciting. And I would, if I look at these, 99% of them are with my wife to bring some excitement to the year, even though I might be heads down on work seemingly every day.
So there's so many elements to your story that we're just going to bypass for the sake of time. But just to do a quick highlight reel, you have house hacked in San Francisco, and you did it before you knew it, that house hacking was even a word. You sold a company to Google, and you also maintain an incredibly high savings rate. And then we've kind of laid the groundwork so people understand you have this constantly optimizing mind. You're constantly identifying and seeing problems and seeing how you can implement a solution. You're also known in the Silicon Valley space as the personal finance hacker. Like, you're the guy. So you've hit FI three ways over. 2 months on the couch, and you're thinking to yourself, what can I build next? Practically, what does that look like for you?
I think one of the interesting things about being so obsessed personally with finance and life hacking and optimization is that you end up being this go-to resource for not only people professionally, but friends. And I found that everyone was coming and saying, hey, you love doing this. I don't. How do I do this? And I felt like there was an overwhelming demand from people to make sense of their financial life, figure out if they're on track. Even if they weren't interested in the kind of FI approach or the FI community, it was, what can I do to make sure I'm better and on track for everything I care about? And so for me, the goal might be financial independence. For someone else, the goal might be retirement or being able to afford to pay for their kids' education. You know, the way I did it was through a bunch of kind of future cash flow modeling to try to figure out whether I was on track and whether I had enough and, you know, taking into account market performance. For other people, that is just a super overwhelming thing to do. It wasn't just a problem with my friends, right? If you look around the country, 81% of Americans don't know how much they need to retire, and 55% won't have enough to retire. So it seemed like, man, this is a real problem. People don't know what they're doing, and it's causing them more stress and anxiety than just about anything else in their lives. And how do you help them? So I thought, well, this is not a problem that just started this year. I was like, surely someone else has solved this. I don't need to spend my time on it. And as I dug in, I looked around and found that the financial advising space is just not anything that I or anyone I would want to recommend to should get involved in right now. There are so many people. I think 9 out of 10 financial advisors in the U.S. do not have a sole fiduciary responsibility to act in your best interest, meaning that, you know, 9 out of 10 in some capacity have a broker relationship where they can sell you things and make money and have no obligation to do what's best. Like, it seemed crazy. The average cost of working with a financial planner to get a financial plan was over $2,500. And most financial advisors don't work with people who don't even have $1 million. So I didn't have any place to send any of my friends, family, people who kept asking me for help that was reasonably priced, that I felt good about acting in their best interest, or that I felt like would actually drive any meaningful value to their lives. The reason wasn't that there weren't people that passionate about this. There were tons of certified financial planners or CFPs that were super passionate about solving this problem, but the entire technology stack that they used meant that the way they collected information was having people print out their bank statements. The way they delivered information was a binder with 100+ pieces of paper that, you know, if a client knew how to read and comprehend, they wouldn't have asked for advice in the first place. And so it seemed like, wow, if we could take the experience that I had from building software and technology and apply that to this industry, we could take financial advice that was always in your best interest, that was done by working with a real human advisor who is smart and experienced, and the software would let the entire experience feel modern, feel fresh, not feel like stacks and stacks of paper, and could bring the cost down to something that, you know, most people could afford and could help them get a grasp on whether they're on track and really start to feel confident about their financial goals.
So, Chris, obviously the problem is clear. I get that. And it is a conundrum when you think about it for the regular CFP. Their time is valuable and it takes a long time to, like, if you and I, Chris, if we wanted to sit down and teach someone how to ultra optimize our lives, I would love to do that. Like, nothing would make me happier, but you can't scale that, right? Because it's so many hours. And that's what a CFP is coming up against. And that's why I guess those financial plans do cost upwards of $2,500. And, you know, I'm not sure precisely what they're even getting for that. And also then you said they need $1 million of assets to get in the door. So that shuts out the vast, vast, vast majority of people. So are you saying that your solution with Grove is really some function of using technology to cut through the needless time-wasting stuff, but still applying a hands-on actual human-to-human connection?
Yeah. So what I identified and kind of the inspiration behind starting this company, Grove, was people are all unique and their situation varies. And if that situation isn't understood, it's impossible to give real specific actionable advice. So humans are great at that problem. Humans are really good at understanding people. Software lacks there. But humans are definitely not better than software at looking at the balances of different accounts and running financial models and simulations and generating beautifully designed explanations of how things should work and what life looks like. And really, that slows them down. The idea was, take the thing humans are really, really good at, but use software to make the rest of the experience much more modern. And instead of going to an office and meeting with someone, or having a financial advisor take you out to dinner, which while they're paying for it, you know, in the long run, you're really paying for it. Let's make a product that really matches the attitudes and feelings and lifestyles of people today, which is, I'd much rather be able to schedule this whole thing online. I'd much rather fill out a form on the internet than fill it out with a pen and paper. And I'd much rather just do something on my own time, whether it's nights, weekends, or the weekday, than have to go to an office between 9 and 5 downtown in some place Monday to Friday. So if you make all of that stuff efficient and you let the human advisor do what they do best, you end up with this amazing experience where you can feel understood, your personal situation is taken into account, but because software is doing so much, it's actually reasonably priced.
So look, let's go ahead and talk about the price model. What are we looking at? Is it a subscription-based service, or how do you set it up?
When we thought about this, we looked, average cost being $2,500. We really want to have an impact. So right now, if you sign up, the cost is $600 a year. You know, for $600, we get to know you, your family, your financial situation. We deliver a kind of personalized and actionable financial plan. Your accounts are synced so we can monitor them and give proactive guidance throughout the year. If you want help managing your investments, we can do that for you, but we don't have to. And we try to leave people with, like, not just, you know, you should be in lower risk stocks, but here's the exact portfolio we'd recommend in line with your risk, in line with your goals and your timeline and your family. If you're trying to achieve financial independence in the next 5 years, this is what we think you need to do to be there. And so that's kind of the way we think about all of this. That's the way the approach all of the CFPs on our team take. And the goal is really to personalize it around your goals.
So it's interesting that you mentioned specifically if you're trying to reach financial independence, because I think for many people that has the connotation of an earlier retirement timeline. And I think that's one of the things that our community is very interested in. You're obviously talking to a very targeted community that's very interested in this idea of early retirement, but that's not necessarily the sole community that you built this for. You had this in mind for the broad swaths of the population. And I'm curious, how does your team, like, what would that experience look like, both for the early retiree or the potential early retiree, but also just for, like, hey, mom, I know you're looking for an advisor, you're looking for someone to help you with this. Go check out Grove, and, you know, what can they expect?
Everyone has different goals. And if the goal is to hit financial independence at, you know, 35, that's one thing. But someone else might have a goal to buy a house at 35. So they need to save the down payment. Someone else might need to save a little bit more to be able to be financially independent. And someone might say, you know, I don't care about either of those things, but schools in my district aren't great. And so I want to send my kids to the best school. So I need to get in a place where I can afford to send them to private school every month. It's one of those things where the goals, you know, from a data standpoint, are just amounts of money you need each year. And that lets the models that we've built and the software we've built treat goals similarly, but there's some nuance to each of them, which is why, you know, I think our advisors are good at understanding the difference. So helping someone with vastly different goals is actually not that fundamentally different. It's really just all about understanding them better and helping people figure out the exact concrete steps they need to take towards getting to be on track for them.
Chris, I'm curious, many people in the FI community are dubious of financial advisors, certainly. They're the assets under management, fees, and just fees in general. But certainly $600 sounds reasonable if there's value there, which it certainly seems like there is. But how would you convince this person in the FI community who's naturally skeptical of financial advisors of the value that they'd get from a full financial plan and, I guess, from Grove in general?
Yeah. So first step, they're right to be dubious. You know, if 9 out of 10 people don't have a sole fiduciary responsibility to you, I would be dubious as well. It means that, you know, you're going to have to talk to 10 people before you find one that would say, we will always be acting in your best interest. So the dubious nature is totally understood. What I would say is we take that responsibility. If you're thinking that you want to work with someone, you should look for someone who also is taking that responsibility. And you should look at yourself and say, is this something that I'm willing to do? Am I stressed out about money? Am I unsure if I'm on track? Would I benefit from having someone review my spending, review my financial situation, my, you know, all the accounts I have, maybe if I'm still employed, what employer options I have for retirement savings or health savings, and help me figure out what the best use of every dollar that I save is to achieve my goals. And so we look at all of those things. We make recommendations on how to take advantage of a 401k or an IRA, or if your company has an employer stock purchase program. And we look at your spending to figure out how that looks over the long run and whether it works out. And we'll make specific investment recommendations. If you want, we'll manage that portfolio. And if you don't, we'll tell you how to do it yourself. So our goal is to make everything so actionable that you can do it. And then, you know, right now, some of those things we can do for you. Some of them we can't, for just kind of obvious regulatory reasons. But the goal in the long run is to get to a point where as much of it as you want to manage, you can. And as much of it you want us to manage, we can as well.
That sounds really cool. And it sounds like a real significant array of services. And I'm curious, throw this back on you. You sound like the most skeptical FI person there is, right? Which is cool. Like, you even talked about, hey, this life-changing TED experience that hypothetically, like, I'm not sure if I would go because of the cost. But put yourself as the CEO of Grove. How would you convince Chris, the FI community member, that the $600 a year is worthwhile?
Yeah, the way I would convince myself is I would say, look over the last year. Did you actually go and do the things you wanted to do? If someone wants to go buy 3 or 4 books on financial planning and read them all and figure out what they need to do and build a spreadsheet and a model, you know, that's great. And I would encourage people to do that. And I'd be happy to share my knowledge to the best I can. But ultimately, what we find is a lot of people want to do that and most people don't. And if you look back over the year, the value of not optimizing your situation can be really, really large. You know, the value of not taking advantage of a 401k for 1 year could certainly, over, you know, a 30-year period, be much greater than $500 or $600 a year. It could be thousands of dollars. So I think the answer is, are you doing what a financial professional would do right now? And if not, is it worth thinking about hiring someone, you know, be it us or someone else, to do that for you and help you think through those things? And then the second question is, are you confident if you are doing it yourself? Because there's nothing worse than, you know, living your life in a constant stress of, am I making the right decision? So we think of ourselves a little bit like a personal trainer for your money. I can go to the gym and, you know, maybe I can create an exercise routine that works. But there are lots of people that aren't really confident they're doing the right thing, and they want to make sure that they're making the most of their time, and in our case, money. So they hire a personal trainer to help them come up with a regimen, come up with a workout plan that's specific to their particular goals, and then help keep them accountable. Have someone come in and say, hey, have you done that thing that you're supposed to do? And so I'd say, if you're not doing it yourself, obvious opportunity to start taking action for your money. Or if you are doing it yourself, but you just want that, you know, validation point or confidence that you're actually making all the right decisions, and you want that from someone who's, you know, an experienced professional in this industry, I think either of those two points would make a pretty compelling case for someone to consider working with a financial advisor.
And the point you made up was so perfect. I mean, we have this post that we post on our Facebook group once a week asking people, you know, what is the one place that you took action this week? And the reason that post is so popular is because the norm is to not take action. It's just to graze through life. And so I think there's probably an individual listening to this right now that is the ultra optimizer, that's got everything figured out. He's got his drawdown figured out for 20 or 30 years from now, when he or she is actually going to need to use it. And they're thinking, well, I don't need that. And they're probably right. They probably don't. But that is like the vast minority. So many other people do not have a plan and are not taking those steps. And wouldn't it be nice if you just had a default gateway that you could just point someone towards? And so their path is on autopilot. They just get that, they get their input, and they can start enacting these changes a little bit at a time. And I think that it just makes sense.
Yeah, and Chris, that's funny, because taking action was what I highlighted there too. And it's easy to say that you're optimized, but I know myself, I have a cash drag on my entire portfolio because I have not been as optimized as I'd like to believe that I am. So that means leaving money in checking or savings when it should be getting pumped into, in my case, low-cost index funds every month. And I just have not been as diligent as I should be. And I'm thinking, as you're going through that explanation, wow, you know, maybe I could take advantage of that, which is basically putting it on automatic and getting someone else to look over this, as opposed to leaving it up to you, who may or may not take action. So yeah, I absolutely love that. And just one follow-up question, which is, how do you think, like, your FI life and your FI lifestyle have impacted Grove and any of the advice that you may give or your company may give through this new platform that you have.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly helped the company. There's an amazing kind of extremely frugal attitude in the office. You know, we're a company, we're, you know, trying to be efficient as well. And I think my attitude has spilled over to lots of people. And so certainly has an economic benefit on everyone being super frugal. So that's great. And I think the other thing that's super magical about financial independence is when you achieve it, I don't think that's the point in time where everyone's trying to just stop working. But once you're there, it puts you in this great position to be able to work on only the things you truly care about. And so what I think has made this company so fundamentally different from everything I've ever done in my career is that I'm only doing this because I absolutely love it. I could have chosen to be the person who sits on the couch or just phones it in and doesn't really do much. But I'm doing this because it's the one thing in the world that I want to dedicate the next, you know, decade or more of my life to. I think that attitude makes the ability to come to work, makes the excitement in the office just so strong. And, you know, I know my co-founder's in a similar situation and, you know, lots of people on the team are in a similar place. Leslie, who's our director of financial planning, had her own financial planning practice that she ran by herself and shut it down to come join Grove because she wanted to be able to offer the same services she was offering for, you know, that $2,500 plus price point to many more people at a much lower price. So we have like a team of people that all have this attitude of, I'm working on this not because it's a job where I can make money and go home and clock out. It's I want to make this impact on the world. And I think that's a thing that financial independence lets you do in a way that is sometimes difficult otherwise.
Grove sounds fantastic. And I can't wait to share this idea with our community. Let me ask you this right now. You've had one company that got bought by Google in the past. How big of a check would someone have to bring to the table for you to walk away right now?
I don't think we're at a point right now where we'd walk away unless someone basically said, you know, and it would have to be in writing, we just want to be a part of this and you can continue running it as much as you want. We're just going to lend all of the expertise and experience we have so that we can make it, you know, more accessible, more affordable, you know, those kinds of conversations I'd be interested in. But if someone just wants to buy it and have me walk away, I don't think there's a number right now.
I completely agree with you. I mean, that is what I have said to Brad over and over again. There is no number. When you're a part of something big, when you feel like you're truly having an impact, that's when you know you're in the right place. And the litmus test for that would have to be, is there a price at which I would walk away? And I don't have one right now. I am truly doing what I love. And I think that's a good sign that you're no longer doing it for the money. Normally, that would be the end of the episode. But on this show, we would love to give you a chance to tackle the hot seat. Are you ready for this?
I am.
In a world drowning in debt and rampant consumption, trapped by the chains of lifestyle inflation, these questions highlight the secrets of those who have broken free. Welcome to the Choose FI Hot Seat.
All right, Chris, question number one, your favorite blog that's not your own.
I've been really obsessed with Memorandum, which is a political news aggregation site, which I don't know if it officially counts as a blog because it's a blog aggregator, but you know, politics is crazy in our country right now, and trying to stay on top of it while running a company is hard. And I feel like they do such a good job of scooping up stories from the right, from the left, aggregating it all, and really kind of organizing it by what you don't want to miss.
Yeah, politics is something that I used to follow obsessively, but just in my kind of path towards happiness, that's one of those, we call them alligators around here. So we had the happy philosopher on our show, and he talked about alligators and kittens. So alligators are the things you want to take out of your life that aren't adding value, and kittens are the things that are bringing you value, bringing you happiness, et cetera. And for me, I just found that politics was one of those alligators. But that all said, going back to my old life, that does sound like a really cool way to get your news in a hurry. I like that.
I try to stay so far away from the news. Like, I just don't want to know. Just wake me up in a few years. Let me know if we're all still here. All right. Question number two, your favorite article of all time. Now, this can be one that you wrote. I know you have a personal blog, or it can be someone else's.
Yeah, so I would say I get an email or a tweet or some question about what the best credit card is 1,000 times a year. So finally this year, I just wrote an article. It was the first post I put up on chrishutchins.com. And the goal was, I'm just going to answer that question online. And so right now it's my favorite article because I don't have to keep writing an email, you know, a couple times a month.
We did the same thing, didn't we, Brad? We did episode 9, just kind of our gateway intro, because you do. You're always starting with the same place. You're always having to tell someone, no, your credit's not going to go down. In fact, it might actually go up. And then here's the basic premise of where to start with. And I was actually genuinely surprised at how optimized you are. I mean, you've really figured, like, you really tracked this down to the penny. It's very impressive. And you have a lot of, I'm sure you have a lot of great tips there on kind of how you break down your spending, because you actually use different cards for different things year round, right?
I think I probably have about 16 cards. I probably actively use 14 or 15 of them. So yeah, I'm pretty far down the rabbit hole when it comes to maximizing the points I earn on my credit cards.
That is so cool. Very, very impressive. All right, Chris, question number 3, your favorite life hack.
So I don't know if this is a life hack or not, but there's a company that came out in the last few years called Peloton, and they make this beautiful indoor cycling system, and it just happens to cost about $2,500. So this year I figured out, okay, here's everything you need to do to build this at home for a whole lot less. So my favorite life hack is that I now can work out at home on equipment that would normally cost $2,500 for about $300.
$300 total. And then I think the Peloton has an app that is a subscription as well, right?
Yeah. And for some crazy reason, if you buy their $2,500 bike, you pay $40 a month for access to their content. And if you build it yourself, you pay $13 a month for access to their content.
And I know you wrote, because I've seen those Peloton ads on my Facebook thread, and I know you wrote an article showing exactly how you did this. So we'll link to it in the show notes.
Yeah. And I don't know, I'm a big fan of the product. I just, you know, I can't justify spending that much money on it.
I love it so much. It's great, man. All right. Question number 4, your biggest financial mistake.
So we didn't talk about this at all, but back right after laid off camp, my wife had decided she wanted a new job, and she joined a small company that a friend of a friend started called Zimride. And we were talking about whether to advocate for equity or salary. We leaned towards salary because we weren't sure what the future of the company was. It turned out that that company she joined as like the 5th employee became Lyft, and she's been there for 8 years. And I think we look back to that day all the time and say, wow, we really should have taken the equity in that company over the salary.
Ouch. Yep.
Holy cow. Holy cow. So she was the number 5 employee at Lyft and could have had equity?
No. So let me clarify. She had equity, but you know, you kind of, which one do you want to negotiate harder for?
Gotcha. Okay. Sorry.
You know, we negotiated harder for dollars, which, you know, maybe was, or definitely was, the poor choice in the long run.
Wow. Okay. Question number 5, advice you would give to your younger self.
I would say, go look at what's going on in Silicon Valley and don't even think about another career. Like, the fact that I was obsessed with technology and had no clue that people were out here building companies and being entrepreneurs, and, you know, it would have fast-tracked at least 2 or 3 years of my life.
And that's interesting to me, because one of my questions has been like, does this work in other areas of the country? Is Silicon Valley, is that the magic ingredient to making these startup dreams become a reality? And it sounds like you're saying definitively for your younger self, yes.
Yeah. I mean, I guess even just exposure to the fact that it existed, you know, I guess knowing that building companies for a living that are live on the internet is a thing you can do. You know, I grew up in Northern Virginia. AOL was started there. Maybe the advice isn't such that you have to do it in Silicon Valley, but just like, understand this is an option and a thing you can do. I think I had no clue.
All right, man. Now we do have a bonus question for you. No, we've spent the majority of the show talking about things that you didn't place enough value in to buy. You didn't go to the TED Talk. You didn't do the cruise. We want to know, what was your favorite purchase made last year on Amazon, or if not on Amazon, from any other place?
I'll throw out a couple, and they were all really cheap. So one, this company Kavage makes an iPhone case with a built-in wallet on the back. And despite that I love credit card points, I hated carrying around a wallet. So now it's not just my favorite purchase this year. I bought it twice this year because I changed iPhone. So it's definitely got to be a favorite purchase if I bought it twice. And then another silly one that has brought me so much joy because it's just made me feel like I'm making something more valuable is I bought an oven thermometer and realized that our oven was totally miscalibrated and, you know, cooking things totally terribly because it was, you know, it would say 350 and it'd be at 425. So the satisfaction I get using our oven now for like a $10 thermometer that made it all perfect is, you know, something that lives on every time I use it.
Oh, I'm so glad you gave us two. All right, Chris, let's go back to Grove for a second. Someone listened to this and they said, I have the perfect person. They need this. They need this in their life. I've been trying to figure out where to send them. I don't want to send them to 10 people to find one good one. What is the best way for someone to connect with you and connect with Grove?
Yeah, if you go to hellogrove.com/choosefi, you could do two things. You can get started with a free financial checkup that we have, and you can also join an intro session with one of our certified financial planners.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, buddy. This has been a blast.
Yeah, thank you. I'm really excited.
All right, guys. Well, I hope you got value from this episode. You know, there's so many different aspects that came into this, and we could have probably talked to Chris for 2 to 3 hours going into each one of them. We felt like Mad Scientist did such a good job diving into some of the other components of Chris's story that we really wanted to highlight some of the, basically our follow-up questions to that interview. And I think it comes through that this is a guy that gets it. And this is the natural progression of someone that has reached FI, but has all those characteristics that we continually highlighting it. It's that desire to build something. So Brad, I was incredibly excited with just seeing how the story came to life.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, this was a fantastic conversation. I absolutely loved it. Chris is a true member of the FI community. There's no question about that. And to your point, we could talk to him for hours. So hopefully we'll have him back on. Maybe we can talk about that, building a business or getting your first hires or even going back to house hacking and travel rewards. I mean, he's an expert on all of these things. And we just didn't even touch on them because there are so many other items in his story that are fascinating. So yeah, really, really cool. And frankly, Grove sounds like a fantastic company. I love his passion. I love that he is trying to take his knowledge and his skills and his FI perspective and bring it to the financial advising business, which, as we know, is kind of frustrating for people looking to get good advice without breaking the bank. So yeah, it really sounds like a top-notch company, and I'm excited to see them grow in the future.
All right, guys, if you got value from this episode, if you've been getting value from the episodes up to this point, go ahead and take 1 second. Just press the subscribe button. It just lets the providers know that you want to be here when we produce additional content. And if you want to support us and what we're doing here at Choose FI, here are 4 easy ways. 1, leave us an iTunes review. If you want to do that, just go to chooseify.com/iTunes. 2, use our page to sign up for travel credit cards. If you want to travel the world with miles and points instead of your hard-earned dollars, then just go to chooseify.com/cards and get started today. 3, if you're working on the milestones of FI, set up a personal capital account to track your progress and use our affiliate link. It's completely free, and just go to choosefi.com/PC. P as in Paul, C as in Cat. And 4, and most importantly, find your friends, coworkers, and family members who might be open to this message and tell them about the podcast. Have them start with episode 38, The Why of FI, and right behind that, have them go listen to episode 21, The Pillars of FI. It is a fantastic starting place. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth, one life hack at a time.